Hi,
Hi,
Calvin.
Adam.
Hi. We've just done a wonderful recording session on tetrionics, and specifically on the part where you were describing the P versus NP problem solution. And in the reflection on what we had discussed, you said that there would be a lot more that could be said just by looking at the slide. And I would invite you to do just that. But I'd also like to suggest that maybe my looking at the slide could be used as a starting point so that my questions can lead to your views on it. And that in a way you can help me and everybody else who looks at the slide to come to understand the in-depth of it, because as you have said at many occasions, within your picture there are so many layers, and of course we already all know the phrase, every picture is worth a thousand words, and in your case it's probably more than that, because you have many pictures combined, so there's so many layers involved. Will that work for you, that I just look at the picture, mention what I notice, and that you then go into it?
Yeah, by all means.
Okay, so for everybody looking at the picture, this is a slide called Tetrionics 98.05, and it is about the P equals NP issue. Basically, it's about the relation between information and physics. The P versus NP problem is about how quickly can you do calculations, which we have just discussed in your wonderful expose on how tetrionics solves that. But now the idea is to just focus on the page and look at what's on it and to put it all in place.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at it, first of all, I see this diamond shape figure, and I can't quite say if it is a checkerboard looking up or looking down. It has this Escher kind of quality of it can be up, it can be down. On the side, I see these rainbows of colors. On the one side it is called bosons, on the other side it is called photons. And I know that in tetrionics, bosons are half photons. So a boson is the Planck unit. It is represented by a triangle. And I know that in tetrionics, a photon is the combination of two bosons, two Planck units, and they have the form of a diamond, which is what we see as the little diamonds with their beautiful colors, and as the diamond as a whole.
Yeah.
So could we just stay at that level for the moment? Later I'd like to come up to this circle I see around it. After that I'd like to ask you more about these symbols that I see around it, with this miraculous kind of symmetry, like 2 to the power of n and n to the power of 2. But just for now, what are we seeing with this diamond in the middle and the bosons on the left and the photons on the right?
Right. I mean, like, this all goes back, as you've hinted, to zero-point fields and to fields of any type. In this particular example, as you mentioned, with the diamond shape that predominates the illustration, we have an electromagnetic field. And within that electromagnetic field, we have Planck quanta, the equilateral foundational building blocks of energy momentum. As we add more and more to this field geometry, the EM field geometry, the count of these quanta, the number of them, is measured either as a frequency, E equals HF, as the blue right-hand side shows at the top, the big E. E equals HF is a measurement of photons, the frequency, plus and minus geometries, which are diamond shaped. So as you said, looking through that illustration, you can see the diamonds are color coded red, orange, yellow, green, aqua, blue, violet, or indigo violet. And that's done in this case left to right, which is the longitudinal direction. It's always referenced, longitudinal or transverse is referenced with respect to the vector direction of the wave, or the vector direction is the best term. You can have, in this case, it's collinear with the linear momentum, same direction, so it's a longitudinal wave. The color coding in this case for the diamonds is longitudinal, same direction. The orange, the yellow, the green all line up the same direction as the linear momentum in this case. If the linear momentum were to be pointing up out of the page, we would have a transverse wave moving towards the detectors either side. So that's just a quick sideline. But as you mentioned, there's also on the right hand side not only E equals HF for photons, but there's a Q, and that illustrates and points out that every field, every Planck quanta has a charge, and even electromagnetic fields, which are considered to be electrically neutral but have strong magnetic fields, even they have positive and negative charges in their orientation. And you can see that on this illustration by the outside edges of the diamond being red or black, and that indicates the red being positive charge, the black being negative charge. And you'll see that there's a black N and a red N just above the arrows. That just indicates that that field can contain any amount of N quanta, and that for, say, an example, for example, this field has eight quanta of linear momentum, which is created by 8 squared Planck quanta. And that's a common physical relationship where the linear momentum is the square root of the energy, or momentum squared is equal to the energy of the field. That relationship is a geometric relationship. It's expressed mathematically, as I just stated there, but it's a result of the geometry of these fields. Now, in the case of bosons versus photons, the energy of the field remains the same, but all you're doing is changing your direction of measurement. Longitudinal, as we discussed, is photons, they're the diamonds, but we all know that bosons are equilateral triangles or rhombic geometries, which are perpendicular to the longitudinal or transverse measurements, which would create quantum levels. And these are all odd numbers. There's always an odd number of Planck quanta or quantum charges in every level of a EM field. Doesn't matter whether it's positive or negative. In this case, you can see that I've written positive numbers down the side and negative numbers down on the right-hand side of the triangle. And you'll see within the triangle, inside the diamond, you have positive squared numbers on the top left-hand side, and on the bottom right-hand side you have negative squared numbers. But directly opposite them, for each level, there is an odd number. If you add up each consecutive odd number, which is a boson, you get a squared number. So 1 plus 3 is 4. 4 plus 5 is 9, 9 plus 7 is 16, 16 plus 9 is 25, and the pattern goes on forever. It's a geometric expansion, or a geometric series of odd numbers, summed to be a squared number. Mathematicians are probably more familiar with this not being explained this way, but traditionally explained as Fermat's difference of squares is an odd number. So where would the difference between 64 and 49, which are 8 and 7 squared respectively, is 15. You can see all that within the information that's numerically stated, but it can also be color-coded. In quantum mechanic ebook, you won't see this highlighting of the photon distribution so much as you'll see the color coding of the quantum levels or the bosons. There's another illustration, I'll just find it for you, which summarizes this, and that's 91.05. It directly shows the EM wave with both color codings on it, and it shows that if you measure it in a transverse direction, you have bosons, and if you measure it longitudinally, you have photons. And they're both equated to the energy of an EM wave through Planck's quanta. NH nu squared, or NH nu normally, which is just N Planck quanta, equals the energy of the field. And likewise, E equals HF, which is the frequency of the Planck quanta. Now, where it has come unstuck historically and in mathematics is that people often see H nu and say the word Planck frequency and then equate that directly to HF. Tetrionics shows that there are two Planck quanta, 2V equals HF, as illustrated right at the extreme left-hand side of the EM wave. It clearly shows that you need two Planck quanta to equal one photon. Whereas mathematics commonplace now, if you look through the physics books and the mathematics, you see that H or NH nu equals HF. Technically it's correct because the N in the front means any amount of numbers, but it's extremely misleading because it's not precise. And that's what mathematicians stress about their work and the mathematics. It is a rigid, precise description of the physics at work. Tetrionics shows that that's not the case. So what I do in tetrionics is I color code them. I color code the longitudinal waves, as you see with the diamonds in this case, in the diamond field has got smaller diamonds that are color coded for longitudinal photons. And you'll note that if you look transversely, the lines are also color-coded for each quantum level. There's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, etc., running through, just like there are with the diamonds. But those lines represent odd number quanta or bosons, specifically W plus or W minus bosons in physics. So we get a far more precise information content in the simple color coding and the geometry of the fields. That geometry, if you look back on the original illustration we started with, still exists. You can still see the color coding for the boson energy levels, or the boson quantum levels, I should say. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue is there, but the first time we discussed this illustration, and even at the beginning of this discussion, most people would not have picked up on those lines being color coded. So there's at a quick explanation there, we've got charges being transverse number of quanta, which are always odd, and we have photons, which are longitudinal measurements of the same energy, but they're always dual quanta, positive and negatives, to make up these diamond shapes, which in turn, the diamond shape of the photons dictates that an EM wave made of photons will also be a diamond shape. Geometry is the key. It's the king maker, the rule maker for everything in physics. Mathematics is just pattern recognition from our scale of the universe looking down. The geometry gives that pattern that we reinterpret as math. And then again, as I just explained, we don't always interpret the math correctly, either through a lack of understanding of the geometry and what is or is not possible so far as a geometric manipulation, or through sheer inaccuracies in the language we use to describe the math symbols. A further example of the information that's in these fields is that, as I mentioned, we have odd number Planck quanta for each quantum level. so that a change between squared numbers, as per Fermat's difference of squares, is always an odd number. Now you can express an odd number mathematically as 2n plus 1 or 2n minus 1. It's a very simple equation. If you substitute any number for n, you will get an odd number. Either if you use the 2n plus 1 or 2n minus 1, you'll always get an odd number. The question then arises, why mathematically does 2n plus 1 and 2n minus 1, which gives us odd numbers, what significance does that have in physics? Well, the answer to that is simply this. When you change between squared energy levels, particularly for an example for photoelectrons jumping between quantum levels, they go between squared energy levels, what you're actually doing is accelerating or decelerating the electron itself. Now, here again, the English language fails to properly convey, or is improperly used, is probably more important, more accurate, is improperly used to describe what's happening. The word deceleration is the 2n minus 1. So you start with a number, you double it, and you subtract 1 to get an odd number change. For acceleration, 2n plus 1 is the series that you're using, which takes a number, doubles it, and adds 1. Again, an odd number increase. Geometrically, all you're doing is taking away transverse bosons. If you're 2n minus 1, if that's what you're using, you're taking away, you're decreasing the energy content of a field by an odd number. So it goes from one squared number to another, but it has less energy in it. So therefore, the object that field belongs to will slow down. So where you see 2n minus 1, you know it's deceleration. Where you see 2n plus 1, you realize that you're adding energy to the field, which will result in an acceleration of the particle. You will find in a lot of physics books that they don't differentiate between this acceleration and deceleration, and they just call both forms a form of acceleration, with deceleration just being negative acceleration. But they don't enunciate the mathematical formulation for it. They just say it has less energy, so it slows down, or a force acts upon it to slow it down, things like that. Geometrically, we now show that 2n minus 1 is deceleration, which is the loss of bosons from the field, not photons, but bosons. So if you were to lose two quantum levels, you would then be able to lose photons, but one quantum level, you just lose bosons from the field. The boson is the building block of equilateral energy momenta for all physical systems. And it's what creates electromagnetic induction. As you add energy, in Faraday's terms and Maxwell's terms, the energy is electromagnetic, is inducted, it's electromagnetic induction that adds or subtracts the energy. It couples with other bosons to create more energy within the field to accelerate, or it releases bosons to reduce the energy of the field to slow things down. So there again, just within that, we've shown what the positive and negative numbers are. We've shown that the plus 2n plus 1 relates to odd number bosons specifically. 2n minus 1 relates to the same things, but to slow them down. So far as forces, because forces are related to acceleration, positive or minus, makes no difference. The bosons are all odd numbers. We color code them as per that illustration. And we also color code the longitudinal photons, which is the energy momenta component of the EM wave, again in colors, so that we convey information. And each charged field that makes up the electromagnetic field is positive or negative, and it's comprised of squared numbers. So all that comes out of that simple illustration there, just so far as the color coding and the shapes.
Calvin, I'd like to pick that up, because while you were talking about the acceleration and the deceleration, I reflected back on the standard model of the atom, where basically you say that there's an electron orbit, and then the next electron orbit is a whole number wavelength further out, which means that at the level of n plus 1 or n minus 1, you have a transition zone where electrons will not be found. So basically we're looking at the same kind of transition, but now explained as the energy level underlying it all. So in a way, this also is not just as a large scale a representation of, say, a photon with the same diamond shape, but it also expresses this transition of the photon jump or the quantum jump as it is described in the classical Einsteinian Planck model of the correlation
in the Bohr model and
yeah,
in the photoelectric effect.
So suddenly everything is brought back to a simple geometry, and you've now put the 2n plus 1 and the 2n minus 1 already in place. You've already explained that the bosons and the photons are two different ways of looking at the same. In the field, they are seen as connected. At the boson side, it's about charges. At the photon side, it's about the energies. And you've already explained how the 2h nu on the left bottom and the hf, the energy at the frequency level, are connected into that story as well. So, under the image, there is also 2 to the power of n and n to the power of 2. How does that come into the story?
Right. Again, it comes in where the mathematic attempts to relate polynomial to non-polynomial time or non-deterministic measurements. It's part of the explanation, but tetrionics, because of the diamond geometry in this case for the fields, is the energy is measured in frequency f, which is always two Planck quanta. So then you'll see some faint o's beside the f. They just basically represent the scalar positive or negative charge fields, and they're described mathematically as an algorithm of complexity, as it's mentioned underneath the 2n and the n squared. As I mentioned, each charged field within an EM field has a squared number of quanta, and that's where this O n squared comes up. It's a quadratic formula. It's just it resolves to be n squared when you do the calculation. What it's getting at is the heart of the P versus NP problem, and that is, if you have one quanta in a field, one bit, that processes in 1 second, which is the circle around it. We'll come back to that further on, no doubt. But one quanta per second is one triangle. If you wanted to process four times, if you wanted to double the processing speed, it would take four times as many quanta. So if you double, as far as the n is concerned, at the top of the diamond tips either side, plus and minus, to go from 1 to 2 in the n count gives you 4 quanta. As you see where the 2 is on the pink arrow, you see that covers 4 quanta. Equivalently, if you went to 3, tripled the data, you would have 9 times as many quanta required. So this is how it all relates. It resolves back as a relationship between the scalar energy or squared energies of a field that allow you to do a computation with respect to time, how many quanta you can process per second. And normally in the P circumstance you have one quanta per second. If you're going to process something 3 squared or 9 quanta, it would take 9 times as long. And the crux of the P versus NP, as I understand it, is how do we process something that should take 9 times as long as quickly as we would process 1 quanta, i.e. how do we do a 3 squared or 9 quanta calculation on 9 bits of data in the time that we would do the same calculation on 1 bit. In normal computations, we operate on the bits one at a time. 1 quanta, then the second quanta, then the third quanta ad nauseum. And that all takes time. Quantum computing and parallel processing is all about doing processing 1, 2, 3, 4 ad nauseum all at once to get an answer immediately as a result of that calculation. You can't do that in serial processing, the P side of the equation, because you have to operate on each bit one at a time. In the NP side of the equation, you do this calculation in tetrionics using fields of electrical force, either photons or bosons and their linear momentum. And you create the field, which has an inherent geometry, which then allows you to map out the arrangement of Planck quanta in that geometry in that instant of time. If you then superposition 2 fields or measure the force created by the field or measure the light output of that field creates, you can determine things about the field which are equivalent to mathematical operations. So that's where the N squared comes into it. The 2N simply says that as you increase the energy in this EM field, because there's a diamond shape, the number of quanta in that field, i.e. the relationship of energy to the frequency of photons or the number of bosons in that field, is an exponential relationship. And that's immediately apparent in the fact that we have an equilateral geometry. As you keep putting, instead of making the field fixed, if you were to just simply keep adding quanta to the base of that triangle to make larger and larger triangles, the number of quanta added each row is obviously the next odd number. You go 1, then add 3, then add 5, then add 7, then add 9. But each time, you're adding 2 more quanta. 7 plus 2 is 9, 9 plus 2 is 11, which is the sequence of odd numbers. So we've got up to 15, that's the energy in that field. We would have to add another 2 for the next energy level, which would be 17 in total. So it's an exponential. The equilateral geometry of the triangle itself, of the charged field, is an exponential geometry. You'll often see in mathematics infinity used, particularly when you get into QED and quantum mechanics. It's just saying it goes on to a very large number without having to define that number. Tetrionics does it slightly different and just says the energy will be contained in an equilateral geometry. How many quanta that exist in that geometry is determined by how much energy is in that geometry. So if we wanted an infinite number of quanta, we would supply an infinite amount of energy into the equilateral geometry. The geometry, we know that all the Planck quanta are equilateral, so we simply count them. In this case, we're measuring the frequency of the photons, the wavelengths, and the number of photons. They're both related. And because we're measuring frequency, it's 2n squared. It could be 1n, 1 to the n, sorry, yeah, 1 to the n if we were measuring the charge field out to infinity. So it can be any number, it can be 1 to the 1, 1 to the 0 for one Planck quanta for a charge field, or it could be 1 squared, or it could be continuing up to whatever number you choose. But as that number increases, the number of quanta in a single charge field will increase. In this case, because we have a EM field, it's 2 to the N, because there are 2 charge fields for an electromagnetic field. So therefore, and again, because they're equilateral, it's a geometric progression that continues to add odd numbers out to infinity. Infinity isn't something I use in tetrionics. In fact, the third law of tetrionics is that there are no infinities. By definition, everything in the universe is made up of Planck quanta, so there are a finite number of Planck quanta in our universe. Space can be extremely large out to endless, but there is a finite number of Planck quanta, equilateral Planck quanta, that make up our universe and all the physics in it. So therefore, infinity should never appear in a mathematical equation describing physics. It's done as a shortcut, and I describe it as a shrug of a mathematician that doesn't understand that the geometry allows for a endless scaling. The equilateral geometry, we know by definition now, in the first part of this discussion, has a squared number of quanta in the field, and that squared number is made up of a sequential number of odd number bosons, which can be measured longitudinally as photons of a specific frequency for any given energy in that EM field. And those geometric and mathematical relationships are all the result of the geometry, and they allow us to be very precise about putting in a certain amount of energy and getting a certain result. And because it's very precise, mathematical relationship, or based on geometry, it allows us to use an energy input as an initial number state, if you like. So a 8-volt input of energy will have 64 quanta within it. It's not actually that, but as a rough term, there would be 64 quanta within an 8-volt field. And if we wanted to increase or decrease the voltage, we increase and decrease the number of Planck quanta and the distribution pattern that's produced by the Planck quanta when we change that voltage. Just by way of explanation of that, I would look at... Let me see if I can find a good illustration to cover that one. Not that one. Let me see. Illustration... it's important. 27.03. I'll send that through. For those that are looking for it, it's in the QED ebook. But that illustration, which relates the, it's a description of wave function probabilities with respect to the energy level or the amplitude of EM waves. And you can see directly from that illustration, as you increase the energy from energy levels 1, 2, 3 through to 8, the number of quanta changes in that field by this relationship we're talking about. The probabilities numbered in blue, either as a fraction or as a decimal equivalent around the outside of the diamond, changes in accord with the energy and the energy momenta distributions, the arrangement of Planck quanta in that field. And more importantly, if you were to measure any of these fields as they spread out towards a detector, you would get different interference patterns for each energy level. So you can relate the energy level to as a, in this case, an EM wave. You can relate it to say, an electrostatic field where we increase the voltage from 1 volt to 2 volts through to 8 volts, or 1,000 volts through to 8,000 volts, or use millivolts, whatever. It doesn't change the distribution. It does change the distribution for every change of voltage. And then we can have, say, a 8-volt field superpositioned with a 4-volt field, both with different distributions of quanta in them. When they overlap, it creates a third interference pattern between the two fields, which we measure as a diffraction interference pattern. It's modeled presently as circular waveforms, but in reality they're equilateral geometries that are superpositioning. So all we're doing by changing the energy level is changing the number of quanta in each field, as illustrated in that illustration there, and that changes the wave function and the associated probabilities of this EM field that we're using for our calculations, or to model P versus NP. If we want to do more calculations per second at any one instant, we simply increase the voltage. We can see the distribution patterns of the quanta changing, and the interference pattern will change accordingly. The more voltage, the finer and the more numerous the interference bands of light and dark patterns that will be produced. And you can immediately start relating them backwards. If you have a certain interference pattern with certain spacings, you have a certain voltage or energy level creating that interference pattern. Again, where you have superpositioned or interfering, constructive or destructive interfering patterns, it gets more complex, but no more complex than a Fourier analysis of waves and things like that. So hang on with me one sec, I'm just swapping illustrations. The original illustration that you're talking about with the 2 to the n simply reflects that we've got a diamond shaped geometry, 2 triangles out to any number in an exponential geometry, and the n squared simply reflects the energy content within each charged field, and then between them you'll see 2n squared, which represents the energy content given in photon frequencies as opposed to boson quanta. And again, the 2n squared's blue because positive and negative charges create a neutral EM field, where we don't notice the electric component of the field. We do, however, notice the magnetic component of the field, hence the name magnetic field. But it's still an electromagnetic field with force and energy content.
So that's very clear. So the n squared and the 2n squared is basically the difference between bosons and photons, or photons and bosons in that order. And then
geometry,
yeah,
or scalar, yeah,
yeah. And then you also have the n to the power of 0, mm-hmm. which would be the starting point for the basic photon as represented by the whole grid. So I would assume that that is showing that the underlying unity is still at that level, that the diamond shape at that basis represents the single photon, and the more energy you add, the more it expands.
Yeah, what it actually answers the question of P versus NP. It says, and just quickly before we dive into this bit, that circle that you see on the page mm-hmm. is a radial measurement of time. It represents 1 second in tetrionics, and we've discussed this in other lectures. But that puts this entire energy geometry into a temporal measurement of 1 second. So energy per second, which is the same as energy per c squared, or divided by c squared, which is mass. So we have a measurement of mass illustrated here because of the circle around the energy geometries. Now, as I keep saying with this P versus NP, it comes down to how fast you can do these calculations or the manipulation of the individual bits per unit of time. What you're really aiming at is an instantaneous measurement or instantaneous calculation as fast as possible. Within 1 second, how much data can you process? The current question as it's posed is that if you have 1 quanta per second to process 4 quanta per second would take 4 times as long because you have 4 times as much data to process. How can you do those 4 processes as fast as possible, or what's the shortest time? Literally the shortest time would be n to the zero, an instantaneous moment in time. How much can you process in that instant of time? In this case, we chose 1 second, n to the zero. What we show in the illustration is you can process as many quanta as you want, because geometrically we know that all the Planck quanta fill this diamond shape under the energy equation at the rate of 2n squared. So as we increase the energy of the field, or in the field, we increase the quanta in relation to that, either as a longitudinal frequency or as 2n squared, because we have 2 charge fields and there's n squared quanta in each one. So as I summarize it there, I simply state that in the case of n squared, or an instantaneous moment in time, unlike the math treaties on P versus NP that require exponential time to process the information within the field, or process the information that's available, tetrionic geometry of the EM fields, the Planck quanta, utilize an exponential geometry per second, which is just the equilateral geometry per radial measurement of time. If you wanted to measure it in 2 seconds, it would be a circle twice the size. So, and then accordingly, you can put more information. You can measure the time, the interference patterns produced, etc., within that time period. But in an instant of time, 1 second, the geometry of Planck quanta and the geometry of an EM field simply says the more that you want to process, or the larger the number of quanta, you just increase the energy in that field, and that will produce a corresponding interference pattern that we can measure. By relating P to the number of equilateral quanta or energy momenta fields in the EM wave, which will give us PN squared, any number of PN squared data sets can be modeled and processed every second, because the detectors lie outside where the energy is being created. You create the electrostatic field purely by the number, the amount of energy that you have in that field. You know the number of quanta, and you can predict the interference pattern that's produced by the probabilities, the distribution of the quanta in that field for that said energy. You could also measure it in terms of the light output as well, so long as you're able to measure the light of different frequencies outside the visible as well. But either way, whether you measure it as a physical quanta count, or the frequency of light, or a measurement of force, the linear momentum is related to the energy as well by the square root, it makes no difference. At any instant of time, simply by adding or subtracting energy, you vary the number of quanta in that field out to any number you wish, because it's a geometric progression. It always increases by odd number charges or bosons, and it always creates a 2n squared field. and we can measure the light, the interference pattern, or the force. So what became a one-by-one counting process for a computer now becomes a instantaneous measurement process for tetrionics.
Calvin, you've already told me that sometimes you have thought things through so well that it become so simple that you don't really understand why anybody else could have a problem with that. And this is just something which you just did. You have this wonderful phrase, which I sort of jotted down as, by the amount of energy, you know the number of quanta and you know the interference pattern. And in that brief sentence, you have three frameworks of thinking, which you have now brought together, which is logical, because you have already talked before about, in fact, that in tetrionics there is scalability. So it doesn't much matter if you work with bits or with bytes. It doesn't matter if you work with units, because you work with unity. So as soon as you know the unity of the units, then all you have to know is how many quanta are in there. But I'd like you to recapitulate this statement.
That's okay.
Which is the essence of the computation. Because you said per second you can know the amount of energy, you can thus know the number of quanta, thus you can know the interference pattern. In that way, you actually do three kind of information processes at the same time, which means that you have the specificity and the selectivity, as you would call that in number processing. So you basically do the opposite of the Heisenberg uncertainty. You can know the speed and the position because you know that the unit and the unity are always in the same principle pattern. But when you spoke about the energy, the quanta, and the interference pattern, basically you were already describing the computational system of this quantum computer. And I'd like you to just develop that a bit more so that I can chew it again in my mind.
Yeah, for sure. At the very core of tetrionics is this equilateral geometry. And the equilateral geometry is scalable, as we said, out to infinity. You want more quanta, you can make it a bigger triangle or pack more quanta into it. Makes no difference. It's all scalable and they're all equilateral geometries. We also know that the height of these equilateral geometries is the square root linear momentum. And you can validate that. Mathematically, it gets complex, and I've had discussions with mathematicians who will look at the height of the equilateral triangle and say it should be the square root of 3/2. That's fine mathematically, but you're only relating the square root of 3/2 to the side length of the triangle. It's a trigonometric equation that gives that result. It doesn't take into account the scalar geometries. And you can see immediately with the equilateral geometries, as the scalar geometries or the scalar fields are color-coded here, that for as in the case of the O there, a complex system that has of say one, that has one triangle versus a complex system of eight will have 64. So it's a squared relationship and it's a geometric progression. But because we have this geometry that relates energy to momenta in a geometric perspective, not a abstract mathematical description, we now have a tangible finite model that, as well as giving us information about the energy, i.e. the mass, energy per second, the mass of a particle, or mass energy as it's commonly termed, as well as its square root linear momentum, we indeed banish one of the greatest principles that's been in modern physics since its inception, and that's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Because we show geometrically from first principles, i.e. equilateral geometry of energy momenta, Planck quanta, EM fields, that we can indeed not necessarily even measure, but we can model the energy and the momenta of a system at any given instant. Coincidentally, both together. So that we know that for a given energy, we have a given frequency, we have a given number of quanta, we have a given linear momentum, which is related to the energy through the square root, mv squared equals energy, mv being momentum, squared equals energy. So these are not new equations for physics. However, physics has relied heavily on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle as a crutch, because it allows them to say, we no longer know what's actually happening at the quantum level because of this indeterminacy, when in fact tetrionics shows that it is very deterministic at all levels of physics. And as one of the famous statements goes, if you have enough information about a system, you can predict what the system is going to do. Quantum mechanics has relied so long on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle to mask their lack of knowledge that they've come to use it as a formal accepted part of the theory, that it is inherent in the theory, this indeterminacy, when in fact nothing is further from the truth. It's further argued that probabilities, and statistical probabilities in particular, in quantum mechanics, in QM and QED, are a reflection of this inherent indeterminacy, because probabilities are random distributions and outcomes that produce a normal distribution. Well, guess what? We have in this very picture a normal distribution of bosons and photons in the charged and EM fields of this illustration. Hence why I broke it up to highlight Q for bosons and E for photons. Because again, as we get back to the beginning, the first point of this discussion, you can measure this field in terms of not only its bosons and photons, transverse longitudinal quanta distributions, but you can also measure the energy content, the frequency wavelength relationship, and you can measure the square root linear momentum of this system. It's all illustrated there, as well as plotting the distribution of the quanta, be they bosons or photons, within that electromagnetic field. And what does that distribution, the normal, what does that distribution form? It forms a normal distribution, which is normally used to say, well, Heisenberg must be right. There's a random or a distribution of events. There's not a singular event that we can predict coming out. It's a mixture of events that form a normal distribution or a bell curve. That's a reflection of the equilateral geometry, not the randomness of the system. It's not what people normally perceive as a probability outcome. It is in fact a geometric outcome of energy momenta. And again, they're all finite. So as we increase energy of a system, we can measure it in all these terms. We can plot the distribution of all these positive and negative charges as a distribution, and we completely banish the idea of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Absolutely destroy it. And quantum mechanics goes back to being what would have ordinarily been termed Newtonian classical mechanics, where there are distinct actions and outcomes, and we can draw and measure these things. The idea of particles traveling an infinite path that is renormalized in QM is completely explained, and the infinite number is reduced to a finite number of equilateral geometries for any given energy. And that applies to immaterial EM fields as well as material particles. So there's a few major changes that come out of using a simple triangle in physics.
That will probably lead us directly to the rainbow sticks on the right and the left, where you then have the numbers actually detailed for this deterministic distribution. And can you show how this relates? Because these seem to be, in a way, transections of the diamond shape. And adding up to the left and to the right of, on the left the bosons, on the right the photons, but then also with the values to it, on the left it says 1 out of 64 up to 8 out of 64, and on the right it is shown as the decimals. Also for the values of the charge levels and the photon levels.
Yeah, a little bit misleading in that, because the Q bosons, E photons, don't necessarily relate to the photo detector or the interference pattern, left or right. What's actually being measured in those photo detectors, it's an illustration. The diamond-shaped energy of the EM wave in the center of the picture is energy per second. It's a measurement of mass that's being released. And in the case of an EM wave, it radiates outwards in two directions because of the positive and negative charge geometry. In 1 second, we have that diamond-shaped geometry of the EM wave. A split second of a fraction later, that circle would grow out to the point where those two detectors, the two black bars, are. Now, in that EM wave, as the wave continues to expand over time, the EM diamond shape wave becomes larger and larger. But in effect, the red, orange, yellow, green, blue quanta are radiating outwards. So if you had a detector on the left and the right, this is where that error checking bit comes in, measuring, for example, in this case, the photon frequency of light that impacted that detector, this is what you'd measure. At the bottom and the top of the detector, you would measure only one photon of light coming in. The next bar, or bright line in that interference pattern produced, would have a slightly higher intensity because there'd be two photons or two quanta. How do you easily explain this?
Well, you slide the shape through the line, basically.
You basically make the equilateral triangle bigger and bigger per second. But for to fit it on the illustration, I just drew them as what would happen if you could break that photon, that EM wave, in half and just push the two halves left and right out towards the edge of the pages. Simplistically, it's not what actually happens, but simplistically, if you pushed them out, you would then measure on a photographic film or a photo detector a X number of photons impacting that detector. Whether it's left or right makes no difference. For example, if we talk about the left-hand side, if you move the positive charge triangle towards that detector, you'll see that the distribution, the normal distribution of quanta in the positive charge field, will form a pattern, just as the color code shows, that there's one quanta, then there's two quanta, then there's three quanta, then four, then five, all the way up to eight, but then it decreases and goes 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's a normal distribution, which is normally taken to be a bell curve, but it's actually an equilateral geometry of the charge field itself. So if you increase the energy or decrease the energy, what happens is you have more or less lines of differing intensity depending on the energy being recorded on the photographic film or by the photo detector. A photo detector will count how many photons arrive at that detector. A photographic film records the intensity or the number of photons as a brightness compared to just a number count. Doesn't make any difference. If it's a photographic film, you will get the intensity changing as per the color code that's illustrated there, going from red through to violet, back down to red. If it's measured as a count of bosons in this case, it's then the photon arriving at any particular point, for example, the single photon at the extreme outer edges is just one photon out of 64. Next line in would measure two photons arriving at that time, increasing the intensity. Then three photons all the way to a middle intensity, the peak amplitude of eight photons. Now, if you add up all the numbers, 1 through to 8, back down to 1, you get 64, which is the total number of quanta in that field. Equally, one photon out of the 64 is 1/64. Two photons out of the 64 is 2/64. You can express 2 out of 64 is 2/64, or you can express it as what's seen on the right-hand side, as 0.0312. And again, it's just a decimal equivalent of that fraction. If you add up all the fractions, you'll get one unity, which again equals 64 in the quantized sense. Equally, if you add up all the decimal numbers, you'll get one, which equals unity, the total scalar field. These are numbers for the bosons because there's 64 on either side for the positive and the negative charge field. You bring them together, there's 128 bosons in that field. Or you can express them as photons by saying where you have one, you have one negative and one positive photon on the left and the right equals... Sorry, one positive and one negative boson on the left and right hand sides equals a photon of energy. It comes down to your measurement of the field and whether you're measuring light, the interference pattern it produces, the force it creates, or the probability distribution of bosons or photons in that field as to what numbers you produce. In the case of bosons, there are still bosons. This is where it gets really confusing without the geometry and even with the geometry. You see that there's a probability on the left-hand side of 1 in 64 for a single boson on the left-hand side. You see a number that's 0.156, which represents 1/64 on the right-hand side. If you add them together, you find you have 2/64, which is just an increase in the probability. How do I explain this really clearly? What I'm trying to say is, even though you have probabilities of x per 64th in terms of bosons left and right, when you add the bosons together, you still find you only have 64 photons. Even though there's two bosons per photon, if you look closely at the geometry and count the individual bosons within the full diamond shape, there are 64 photons. And there are 128 bosons within the EM field. But if you measure left and right, it still becomes a probability of x per 64. So a measurement of bosons will still give you an immediate answer so far as the distribution of photons in a field. All these
which makes sense, because relationships on the one hand, are geometric. You measure the bosons, on the other hand, you measure photons. So the bosons would be
the unit but of measurement. Yeah, but they both have the same probabilities.
Exactly, because you just count in a different way.
It's exactly. It's counting different geometries. One's a equilateral field for bosons. The other one's a diamond-shaped field, which is twice the size of a boson field, a positive and a negative. But they both give an answer of 64, which is the same distribution. So whether you're measuring bosons in one direction or photons in total, it's still a measurement which is a squared number, or the square of the n number, whatever n, and n can be velocity.
So your system of reference is different, but the result of the measurement is the same, because you're looking at the same, you're just looking at it in a different way. But at the core of it lies the scalability, that you can look at bosons, or you can look at the photons as two bosons together. But that seems to be also the key to the decoding of the P versus NP, that you're able to use two different reference systems and see how they are actually doing the same in a different manner. So that by the scalability, it doesn't matter how complex it is, because you can always scale it down to this underlying principle, which is shown at the left for the boson level and at the right for the photon level. When the energy level goes up, you just scale it, but you essentially do the same.
Yeah, as you That's increase the neat. Energy, you're simply putting more triangles into the geometry. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you measure photons or bosons. The numbers will be different if you're measuring photons versus bosons, but the probability distributions are all contained within what amounts to an equilateral geometry, or a double equilateral geometry. And the fact that these geometries are finite means that it completely negates the idea of Heisenberg's uncertainty, and it also shows that the statistical distribution patterns seen in quantum mechanics are not the result of randomness or a collection of events summing to unity, but they are in fact the reflection of a unity equilateral geometry that's at the heart of quantum mechanics.
So, Kelvin, you've talked about most of the elements on the figure. One seems to be still left to be discussed, which is the F right in the middle, the O shapes to the left and the right of it.
Yeah, you can view the entire electromagnetic field as a function of frequency, F in the middle, as you said, or instead of N, you could actually have plus and minus Q for viewing the field, the entire field, as a mixture of positive and negative charges propagating in two different directions. And again, this idea of propagating in two different directions with positive and negative fields ties in beautifully with Euler's formula as well, which is another whole discussion into itself. But it's just pointing out that the geometry is the unity geometry, that all the math, the statistical math, is a simple function of an equilateral geometry. Even the bell curve itself resolves to be an equilateral geometry, not a curve in quantum mechanics. And it's the geometry, because it's finite, that changes the idea of a random fuzzy quantum foam into these geometries of photons and bosons. And it becomes a finite geometry. It gets rid of Heisenberg's uncertainty. You won't see it mentioned in my work at all. And it makes all of quantum mechanics, and in fact all of the universe, very deterministic. You can start, if you have enough information about the system that you're looking at or modeling, you can then predict the outcomes. You can measure the energy and the momentum, or the position and the momentum, of any particle in the system, including the immaterial fields, at any instant of time, as we indicated here with 1 second. And it's this changing amount of energy per unit of time that gives us physics. As you take a system over a set unit of time and you let it evolve, the energy distribution changes, and the forces and the field mechanics in that system under observation change. That's how we measure physics. If there was no change, we would say that time stood still because the system did not change at all under any influence. So time is frozen. And again, further into tetrionics, I show that time is a measure of this changing geometry. That's what gives us time in physics. The changing geometry and the plane changing Planck geometry in these fields. If they didn't change, we would say time was frozen. So where you have changing fields, changing geometries, energy momenta, that's physics, and that gives us the foundation for time. But it also, by definition, being a finite geometry, rules out Heisenberg completely.
There's quite a lot of information which comes together in just one picture, and as you said, you have so many layers which you can only discern when you really look into it. And I know there's much more to say about this, but I also have the impression that it would be good to round this off, because one of the basic elements which comes in view is that it is all connected. In this picture, where you describe the P versus NP problem solution, you base it all on the relationship of the Planck quanta and how they connect up and can form patterns. Basically, it's about the relationship between the boson and the photon. But at the same time, you use that to address the scalability from the Planck level to the universal level. And there are so many things which you have pulled out, getting rid of the Heisenberg uncertainty, showing that the bell curve is actually the normal result of calculating the amount of energy as bosons or as photons within the system per unit of time. And you also have made use of color coding at the level of the triangle, at the level of the lines, at the level of the outlines with the plus and the minus, so that essentially everything just falls in place. But I'm really glad that we have taken some time to look into the details of it, because now I've been talking a bit more than an hour of just this one page, and it is very evident that every page in all of your work contains so many layers of information. So I would suggest that we come to a rounding off of this exploration of just the one page, in this case of the P versus NP explanation, which essentially is about the scalability from the Planck level to the universal level, which says that if you understand that scalability, then you can increase your computational speed as much as you like. You just have to go to the level of energy where you need to be, which, by the way, is one of the first laws which I wrote down in my first paper ever, is that in biology you see that the level of information must always be at the level or above of energy of the system. I was not able to describe the details of it, but actually this slide just shows it. If you want to work with nuclear energies, as cells do, then you must operate with information at that scale and level as well. And that's what science consistently forgets. Physics looks at the energy, but it doesn't look at the pattern. And with tetrionics, you actually put the pattern back into the story by the geometry. And as a result, energy and information are now immediately connected, which you actually show by having the bosons on the left and the photons on the right. This is so fundamental that it is indeed wonderful to just take the time to look into the picture, to unravel it, and show that it is actually necessary to look into your pictures with all of that understanding, and to see that everything in it has meaning. Now, practically said, the level of consciousness must be at the level of energy or above. Is there more that you would like to add to our exploration of this one page before we round it off?
Like you say, I mean, like, when I developed the illustrations, particularly when I did the year-long revisions to produce what you see here, I had the benefit and the fact that I had the entire model in my head. I developed the chemistry, the QM, the QED, the math, cosmology. So I've got this mental picture, which is where your talks are really key, because it extracts the connections between the various disciplines and the interleaving of information from chemistry and QM, etc., into this one picture. I've layered so much information into one picture in each and every of the pictures in my work that we've now gotten to a stage where the illustrations, although 1,000 times better than the words, fail, because you need the words with them to elaborate on all the information that I'm trying to convey. I see the connections. Other people will see the connections once it's explained and elaborated to them. But until you grasp the basics, build the models, and we have discussions like this, it's very hard to convey in a single illustration all the information that I pack into it. You'll look at the same illustration from a dozen different perspectives, and you'll see more and more information hidden within the geometry. It supersedes the mathematics by itself by a long shot, because it gives us a finite geometric representation of what the math is telling us. Then again, additionally, these are only 2D slices of electromagnetic fields. A real electromagnetic field is made up of millions and trillions of these diamonds all radiating out from the center at various angles to form like a diamond-shaped fan, if you like, a little ball that has countless diamond-shaped EM fields radiating out from the center of its source. So even the illustrations don't give the full explanation, but that's where these talks are invaluable, because it allows me the opportunity to clearly enunciate my thoughts behind the illustrations, to elaborate on them, expand upon them, and to bring all this information out in discussions like this. So again, thank you, Otto, because without it, I'm sure I would have gotten around to it eventually, but not to this level.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, I'll thank you again for talking about this one slide with a couple of accompanying slides to illustrate some points, such as where science went wrong and how it can be set right, how mathematics and geometry show aspects of the same story, how different models of reference can help to see more about the same in more manners, and that this picture specifically was about the complexity of information and the ability to compress information at high intensities and densities. And so it's no more than exemplary that specifically this topic leads to this understanding that when you use information compression, you might need more time to decode it. So it all seems to be very proper. I'd like to close off this recording here.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Calvin, for so aptly showing how much information can be packed in just one image, and how we can actually see how that works in the universe as a whole.
Not a problem. It's been a pleasure.
As usual, I'll hang up and then come back to you again.